This is the Play Board Games Better Recon number 1, Egizia. Recon is not a review or an unboxing of a game or instructions on how to play. I assume you know how to play and own or have played the game. We're going to go over the resources and processes of a game to let you build a winning strategy. I'm not going to suggest a winning strategy because, frankly, I don't have a very successful winning strategy for this game yet. It's early on. But a good understanding of how the game works, structure-wise, and how the actual resources are available, and how many there are, will help you make better decisions while you're playing the game. PlayBoardGamesBetter.com will have pages devoted to the information presented here. You can see pictures and charts with boring numbers of the information we presented, which will make it a little easier to follow along during the podcast. And Egizia, and I sure hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, it's always tough to correctly pronounce the ancient Greek version of a name for another country. Apparently, that's what Egizia is, the ancient Greek for Egypt. Now, the game is played in 5 turns. Each player has 8 boats that they place down the Nile on 20 spaces that alternate between cards and on-the-board spaces. 3 of the spaces are actually building spaces, and those are the only ones that can hold more than one boat, barring, of course, special cards. And there's one less building space in a game than the number of players. That means that in a 4-player game, there's 32 boats, but there's only 26 places that you can place them. So you're always going to have this very tough choice. Do I pick the next resource, because they're all useful, or do I pick the most critical resource, jumping ahead, perhaps missing some opportunities, but getting there ahead of the other players? And one of the other important things to realize in this game is there are 3 building spaces, and you have 3 sets of workers. Now, there's some flexibility with the supervisor, but of course, you can only use one of each on each building space, and you're probably not going to get them all. One of the critical issues in this game is waste. It's probably going to be 1 or 2, or I hope never, 3 sets of workers that you have to provide food for that won't provide you victory points because they won't do anything. Actually minimizing waste is probably the key strategy of the game. So the first thing that we should do is look at the board. As you can see, there's 10 spaces for cards, and on turn 1 and 2, and turn 3 and 4, there are decks of cards for those 2 turns, and there are 22 cards, 20 of which are going to be used. That means that 2 cards will not come into play. When we go over how the resources are distributed in the game, and I have minimums and maximums, the minimums are absolute worst case, unlikely to occur, but frankly, it's unlikely that you'll get the maximum of every resource in every game. And of course, it's fully possible for some resource to be severely crippled. It's not likely, but it's a possibility. So resources that come out early are, well, you know, a bird in the hand is worth 2 in the discard pile. We should probably cut in a discussion of the actual cards. On turn 1 and 2, the deck of 22 cards has 6 field cards, 5 quarry cards, 2 market cards, 5 permanent cards, and 4 one-time use cards. The 3 and 4 deck is very similar, with 6 field, 4 quarry, 2 market, 4 permanent, and 6 one-time. Of course, the one-time cards are more like permanent as you get towards the end of the game. And in fact, for the turn 5 deck, of which there are 12 cards, 2 of which won't appear on the board, there's 1 field, 1 quarry, the 2 markets, 5 one-time, and 3 cards that actually affect scoring. They're much more like the Sphinx card, providing points at the end of the game rather than an immediate game benefit. Now, if you start down the actual board, the very first space is about market moves. Market moves are pretty important. What you want to do, of course, is get some benefit from moving down the track, especially in the agriculture one, where if you're short food, you can change the cost from 3 victory points per food to 2 victory points per food to 1 victory point per food. And then each time you get another market move, taken to calling them bounces, you're going to get 2 victory points, which you could think of as extra food or just victory points if you've got your food situation under control. In the stone market, the first move does nothing. But eventually you get down to being able to turn in stone at the end of the game, 2 stone for 1 victory point. Now, clearly it's not the best use of stone, but it's better than having leftover useless piles of stone. And bounces off the bottom after that will get you 3 stone. For some players, this could be an important source of stone because, frankly, I think it's probably the limiting resource in the game will turn out to be stone. And we'll review why later on. One of the resources in the game that we won't talk about too much is turn order. Having the lowest number of victory points on board at any given time means you're going to go first. And that can be an advantage. In fact, it's a pretty big advantage. You'll get to decide on the first placement, and if there's a resource that you desperately need, you can skip ahead and just get it, no problem. The problem, of course, is that means that you're losing the game, and as you get towards the end, it means you're relying on endgame scoring to shoot you ahead. Now, I think this is actually a pretty good strategy, and I've been beaten with it. However, if somebody's doing that, it's up to the other players to make sure that they get decent endgame scoring as well. The first building spot is the Sphinx. Now, the Sphinx is kind of strange in a way. Unlike the other spaces where, as the game goes on, you need more and more workers and stone in order to build as the small ones get used up, generally speaking. The Sphinx cards are always the same. You can buy 1 to 5 Sphinx cards. Each one costs a worker stone combination. The cards can always be returned for 1 victory point. But from the cards that you buy on any given turn, you're going to get to keep 1 of them, and they're all about endgame scoring. There's 29 Sphinx cards, and they recycle. 5 of them are about the market, and they average 6 points each. 4 of them are about workers. It's the number of certain types that you get. Probably average 6 points, maybe a little higher, because you'll tend to drive whatever worker you have a Sphinx card for higher on your levels. 5 are about the obelisk, and they average 6 points. 3 are about the temple. They average 7 points. 3 are about the pyramid, and they average 8 points. 4 of them are about production, and they average 7 points. 2 of them are about the graves. They average about 7 points, but I think they're very difficult to complete the scoring requirements for those. That makes them tough to use. 1 is about having representation in all the building sites. It's worth 10 points. There's 1 for each of the permanents, and you probably can get about 4 points for those, because it's 2 points for each of the 9 permanents that you have. If you're lucky enough to have a bunch more permanents, I don't know why the other players would let you get away with that, and this card, you can get more points. The big one is the 10% bonus card. It can get you 7 or 8 points, but of course, if you're racking up the points anyways, it can get you even more. So a typical card will score 6 or 7 points if you fulfill its requirements. And you could have 0 to 10 scoring cards, but 3 or 4 is more typical for 22 to 30 points if you can get the job done. Now, it's possible to keep more cards than that. That's one of the permanent cards. And that's why we say you could have up to 10 scoring cards. It's very difficult to do that. You're much more likely to have 3 or 4 if you go after that seriously. The other 2 building areas score points for each worker stone combination you use to build something. Steps in the obelisk, temple, and pyramid, and complete grave sites in the gravesite area. The total number of points available in a 4-player game is 279. 46 potentially on the obelisk, 50 on the pyramid, 54 on the temple, and a minimum of 40 and a maximum of 68, probably an average of close to 54, on the tombs. There are also 25 points potentially for cards by all the players getting and discarding all of them. So it's not very likely that the total building points is actually going to reach that 279 maximum. In fact, it's extremely unlikely. But that means that your share of the maximum is on the order of 65 points. If you get 65 points before the endgame bonuses, you're cleaning up. The other thing that you get, of course, are some points for participation. The cooperation points are 1 for building at 1 site, 3 for building at 2 sites, and 6 for building at all 3 sites. These cooperation points can be pretty significant if you can get them. It's hard to get the 3-ship 1, but it'd be good to get it at least once in a game. A lot of this game is about efficiency. Getting 1 point per worker stone placement is pretty good, but getting more than 1 point is even better. And between the cards, the bonus for cooperation, and the final scoring for graves that you built, that's about it for bonus points. There's a couple available from the pyramid. They're hard to get. And you can get moves on the market whenever you build on the obelisk or build a grave. And those, of course, can get you points too. but it's harder to do. So the resources in the game are food, workers, stone, and moves on the market. They're also your ships, but I guess we won't consider them serious resources. And cards, they're not really resources. They're things you accumulate towards victory. We'll go through the resources one at a time. Remember how they're interlinked. Workers require one food per turn, or it's going to cost you victory points to feed them. The only way to score victory points on the board directly is a worker plus food combination, and your workers are divided into three teams, and you can't just mix and match, and one supervisor that can be added to one team. So the worker resources that are available in the game. In a four-player game, there's 20 at the start, with 5 for each player. And on the first turn, the minimum available addition is 9, and the maximum is 12, plus there's a card for one time add 3 to a team. That means that the available workers are going to be 29 to 35 for the first turn. For the second turn, there's another 9, of course. And if you figure that two of the cards, and this is what the minimums are based on, the two of the worker cards never actually get added to the game, there'll be 3 more. So the minimum available will be 12. The maximum would be 10 if the other worker cards have already come out. Basically, there'll be 42 workers total available for use on turn 2. On turn 3, there's another set of cards. At least 9 more workers will be available, but it's possible that 15 plus 4 one-time use ones will be available. So the total number of workers that people can build with in turn 3 will be somewhere between 51 and 61. Remember, these totals are, the high number is more likely. The low number is very unlikely, but possible. On turn 4, if we haven't added them before, there'll be 12 more added, or 9. Somewhere between 63 and 66 workers will be available. And for the fifth turn, there's the 9 workers that are usually available. Plus, there are one time 5, and 11 more workers that could potentially be added. So the total number of workers available for the very last turn will be between 72 and 82. What that probably means is that your average number of workers that you want to have to stay in the hunt is 7 or 8 at the end of the first turn, about 10 at the end of the second turn, 13 to 15 at the end of the third turn, 15 to 16 on the fourth turn, and 18 to 20 at the end of the game. Net meeting these averages doesn't leave you out of the hunt for first place, but those are the average numbers of all the workers available, divided by 4, and if you don't have something close to that, probably means somebody else is doing better than that. And if they can get the stone and food they need to support it, then unless you can block them from the building spaces, you're in trouble. Now, in order to support your workers, you need food or you're going to be burning victory points. At the start of the game, each player has 6 food, so in a 4-player game, there's 24 on the board. On turn 1, at a minimum, 0 food might be added, but the maximum that could be added is all the food available in the 1 and 2 deck, which is 27 food permanently added to your production, and a one-time 4 food, which means that somewhere between 24 and 55 food are going to be available at the end of turn 1. At the end of turn 2, at a minimum, none were added before. Then there's going to be 14 permanent food and probably the 4 temporary food. At a maximum, we were already at the maximum before, and that means that no more food is going to be added because they could have all come out on the first turn. The total food production available for the second turn is going to be somewhere between 42 and 51 food. On turn 3, at a minimum, 0 more food is going to be added, and at a maximum, 28 more, which means that food production is going to be between 42 and 79. And remember, it'll be 10 towards the high side for these, as the low side assumes that all the potential missing ones are the very highest value food, which is unlikely, but possible. Turn 4, if you're going for the minimum, at least 14 of the food production will have become available because only 2 can be missing. So the end of turn production would be between 56 and 79. For turn 5, it's possible for no food to be added, but the most that could be added is the 1-9 card, and that's one of the scorched ones. So the total food production for that turn is going to be between 56 and 88. If we look at the averages, at the end of the first turn, you would like to be up as high as 14, that being the average for the high production value. On turn 2, somewhere between 10 and 13, the average actually drops a little bit. Turn 3, between 10 and as high as 20. Turn 4, between 14 and 20. and turn 5 between 14 and 22. If you look at the average numbers for food as compared to workers, if you establish the average, you'll have more food than you need all the time. However, some of this food might be in the not very good production, the scorched or medium fields. And if that's true, you could have a problem, and you'd have to spend some effort to make sure you don't have that problem by picking certain spots and moving the Heliopolis disk. So you can keep an eye on that. But you can see that, on average, food is not limiting for workers. But because of the way two cards can be eliminated from the deck by not being included in the game, that balance, which is pretty delicate, could change. So on turns 2 and 4, you could be in for kind of a shock and a scramble for food. So watch for that. The third resource is stone. Each player starts with some stone, depending on turn order, and they start with a quarry of 3. So there's going to be 26 before any of the cards come out. Now the minimum, at least one of the cards is going to come out. They can't all be eliminated. The minimum is to add 2, so that 28 stone will be produced at the end of the first turn. And the maximum would be all the stone cards come out, and the production is 41, or 41 stone are available for the first turn. For turn 2, somewhere between 9 and 2 more stone will be added. 9 only if a lot of stones didn't come out the first turn. So the production will be somewhere between 21 and 27 stone. Notice that it drops because we don't have the first turn addition anymore. Turn 3, somewhere between 2 and 13 stone production could be added. So the production will be 23 to 40. On turn 4, if we didn't have any before, then at least 6 stone will be added. And if we added the maximum, just the 2 more from on the board. That means that the production will be between 29 and 42. On the last turn, it's possible for no stone to be added except the 2 on the board. Or 12 could be added. So the last turn production could be between 29 and 52. Now, on my online charts, you can see the cumulative amount of the resources that are available. The cumulative maximum for food is 352, for workers 286, and you can see why food doesn't have to be a limiting resource, but there are many circumstances where it can be, either for individuals or in the game as a whole. However, the total maximum production of stone is only 202. What this means is that stone is probably the limiting resource in most games. So you probably want to keep an eye on this and not get cut out. If we look at the average available and how much you should get per turn, the averages are, of course, before the game, your production is 3 and you have an average of 4 to start. After the first turn, you probably would like to have a production of about 6. After the second turn, it might not go much higher because not much production is going to come out. So between 5 and 6 is what you could expect to have at the end of the second turn if you're getting your share. For the third and fourth turns, the averages are 9, and for the fifth turn, 12. It's not a lot of stone. If you're only getting the average production, you're going to be looking for stone elsewhere. That means that you want bounces in the stone market at 3 stone each. You'd like to get the production because you take a card and you get some for the rest of the game. But remember that the bounces are available for doing other good things that score you points. Now we should talk about bounces, or market advances. Each turn on the board, there's a potential in a four-player game for 5 market advances altogether. And in each of the decks, 1 and 2 turn, 4 and 3 turn, 5 turn, there are 2 cards, each of which has 2 market moves for each of the markets. So there's going to be a 2-stone market move and a 2-grain market move. If you add these together for the first turn, it's going to be somewhere between 2, it's assuming nobody takes any building spaces, and 9 market moves available. On the second turn, there'll be between 2 and 5 additional market moves, assuming the cards came out on the first turn. On the third turn, again, between 2 and 9. On the fourth turn, between 2 and 5 more. And on the fifth turn, between 2 and 9 again. So what that means is, cumulatively, there's a maximum of 37 market moves over the whole game. And if you get your share of that, in a 4-player game, that would be 9. Now, if you think about getting 9 moves, and you need 3 to get to the bottom of the market before you start accumulating either stone or victory points, if you go to the bottom of each of the markets, that only leaves you an average of 3 bounces, somewhere between 9 stone and 6 victory points. Obviously, you could concentrate your strategy on one or the other. Of course, that would tend to move you towards 10 victory points or 15 stone. And 15 stone is a lot. If you fall behind getting quarries, then you're going to have to go for those shifts down in order to get enough stone to build with for your workers. Because you got to feed those workers, and if they're not producing victory points for you, it's kind of a shame. Now, as we said before, the limiting resource is stone. It can be different depending on how the cards come out, and you might have to shift your strategy on using the market. The market is the only way to make up for misdistribution of cards coming out. So I think one of the big questions to think about is, what is the best worker mix? Played it a few times, but I don't think I've really got it down yet. I've tended to build the workers evenly. But the fact of the matter is, the most you can spend on the Sphinx is 5. And frankly, you might not want to spend more than 1 or 2 on the Sphinx at any given time. It's probably true that you should have a very uneven worker development. Especially towards the end, you might want to be able to spend a lot of points either on the obelisk or a big grave, or to finish off the temple or the pyramid. So it seems likely that you want to have one worker pretty low, one pretty high, one in the middle, and move your supervisor along pretty well. The problem, of course, is that if everybody tries to do that, that's an overview of the resources. Combined with the turn structure, you should have the tools to make reasonable expectations of what you can get out of play of the game and what you can do. Clearly, to increase efficiency, you'd like to get bonuses for all your workers when you place them. You don't want to get just 1 point each time you make a move. And the card distribution for the Sphinx might drive your strategy, but it might also make you want to go fishing for more. Getting, of course, related cards out of the Sphinx deck so that you only have to concentrate on one thing to get a lot of points is probably a good idea. Some of the Sphinx cards are hard to score unless you really concentrate on doing that. Might become kind of obvious to the other players, but remember they don't have lots of resources or time to just block you. It's always a good idea to block the other players, but it's a better idea to just get points for yourself, because you can't tell exactly when you're blocking something that's really important to them or just something that's good. Every move in this game is an advantage. You can't force anybody into making a bad move. You can just force them into making a move that's not as good as the one they'd hoped for. I like that about the game a lot myself, because it makes it competitive. Not that I have anything against cutthroat games. It's just not as cutthroat. But one thing you do want to watch for is not letting one person run away with a resource. And that includes the Sphinx cards, by the way. It's tough to do, but if somebody gets the Keep 2 Cards card, plus the Get 2 Cards free card, they're going to build a Sphinx card strategy. Everybody else is going to have some issues. They can score a lot of points by throwing away cards, but they can also score a lot of points by very selectively keeping Sphinx cards that help them out, or denying them to other players, just because they're going to get to keep some of them anyway. One of the things that's in the game that I don't think people use enough is speculation. On each of the building spaces, there's one less actual buildable space than there are the number of players. But a player may put a boat on there that's out of contention to build. In a four-player game, if you play a fourth boat, it probably won't build. But if any other player doesn't build, your speculation boat not only builds, it takes the spot of the skipped player. So it could move pretty far ahead in the building. Because there's usually more boats than you can place, this isn't a bad move. Now, I have to tell you that it seems unlikely that people are going to skip a Sphinx build unless they've made a mistake, because the cards always help. You can buy whatever number makes the most sense combined with the rest of your builds and your teams, so you never fail to benefit from it. However, especially later in the game, it's quite possible that a build in Amarna or Giza will have to be skipped by one of the players. They won't have the right combination of workers and stone. Something will have happened that just causes them to not be able to do that or not want to do that. In that case, if you have a speculation piece on it, now you'll get to do it. And that could be really good. The other thing that's important about building are the cooperation bonus points. They're pretty good sets of points if you can take advantage of it, and they're pretty bad sets of points to give to other players. We went over the card bonuses, and we mentioned the built-in bonuses. There are also bonuses for the graves, and of course when you build the grave or the obelisk, you also get a move in the markets, which can be very important, especially once you get to the bottom of one of the tracks. That's an important bonus for doing that. One of the things to watch for in the grave area, of course, is that some of the graves are pretty large, and if you run into one of those, somebody needs a big party to build past it. It's good for them because it moves them up quickly on the grave tile bonus, but it also helps out the other players because players who follow will then have a chance to buy graves that are probably less expensive. I think that covers the information you need for Gizia. It's a pretty tactical game. Your strategy might be forced upon you by the other players or the layout of the cards on the first turn, but you can switch it around. There's a couple of points that you should know about the rules that aren't absolutely absolutely clear from the beginning. They're in the notes and clarifications on BoardGameGeek.com. One is, there's a card that says you can build first wherever you have a ship. It's a one-time card, but it applies to all the building zones for the round that you play it. So you always move forward. And in fact, if you're prospecting, you get to build and build first. That won't force another player to switch from building to prospecting, however, but you will get to build. When you upgrade a field, it upgrades it permanently, including for endgame scoring. So if you have a Sphinx card for the majority of a certain kind of field, and you convert one of the other kinds of field to that type, and I don't know if you'd really want to downgrade a field, but upgrading a field would be good. It counts for that also. The last thing to note, and this has been an issue, is if you get the plus two cards for the Sphinx permanent card, you have to build and pay for at least one card before you get the two card bonus, and you are still limited to no more than five cards from the Sphinx in a round, no matter what you have or what else you do. I think that presents all the information that you need to make good decisions in Ekizia. You'll have to play the game a bunch of times to see what strategies work and how the flow of the game happens. We haven't talked about that here. I think it's pretty important. I don't think I have a good handle on it. It's not the kind of thing that's subject to static analysis like the things that I've done here. And I hope this kind of report is interesting and helps you play games better. We're going to do this for about one game a month. If there's games you'd like to see analyzed this way, please let me know. And also listen to our monthly podcast of Play Board Games Better. Thanks a lot.